Good afternoon. Could I have your attention?
Hello.
We're going to get started. My name is Michael Volpe. I'm a partner here at Venable. So thank you all for coming to the Venable Law and Education Forum. This is the first of a series of forums we anticipate having. A number of my colleagues and I were sitting around a few months ago, Ryan Clark, Suzanne St. Pierre, Sue Golden, and others, and we decided to offer a law and education forum on a variety of topics that would affect in-house lawyers, administrators, senior management officials at educational institutions of all types and sizes. And you might say, why are we going to do that? Well, we find the issues that you guys face every day to be most interesting. Some of the most interesting are in the press, which I know none of you like to see. And we have a fairly robust, or I'd say a very robust, K-12 independent school practice and representation of colleges, universities, and law schools. So we thought it would be useful to address the types of issues you face every day. We're going to have four programs per year. That's the plan. The next one is on, get your calendars ready, June 7th. That's going to deal with unlocking the hidden potential of your real estate assets. And my colleagues Suzanne and Sue Golden will be presenting that in this city. Educational institutions have a lot of real estate assets or a lot of value in their real estate, and they're going to give you the keys to the puzzle so you can figure out how to unlock those assets. There'll be other programs in the fall. There are lots of materials you have. The materials include, for those of you that are here, this is being recorded, and CLE is available. This booklet is on your desk. It has a variety of resources in it, including a presentation that one of our panelists will go through. But it also has in the back, which I commend to you, a list of references, which is quite detailed on the issues that we're going to confront today. I only have to introduce one person, Rob Jones, back here to my right, who I asked to come up and moderate this panel. Rob is at United Educators. He had one of the most interesting jobs in the world. He worked for Justice Rehnquist, administering the courts around the United States of America, and he literally knew every judge and knows many, many judges across the country. The only problem with Rob is he's a Penguins fan. Tonight, the Rangers play the Penguins. We had to start pretty close to on time because Rob and I are going to go watch the game, not at the Garden. We did give up the tickets to be here with you all. But he is a Penguins fan, and I'm never going to let him live that down. I did put my flag up. My Rangers flag is up in my office if anyone wants to come see it later. So enjoy the program. Thank you very much for coming. Get the other dates, and please come and see us again, and I give you Rob and the panel.
Thank you. Good evening. This is a playoff beard, and the only way it's going to look decent is if the Penguins go very deep into the playoffs, Mike. So I'm hoping. Anyway, thank you. My first task is to introduce the panel we have here, and starting on my right is Doreen Martin. And by the way, there is a nice biography of everybody, so I'm not going to go into any details about all of their great credentials and their experience, other than say that Doreen Martin and Karen Pass, to my first right, are both Venable lawyers with experience respectively in a lot of white-collar defense, investigations with Doreen in investigations in this area, and Karen Pass, I can only say, is one of the most experienced lawyers dealing with independent school issues in the country. And then on her right is Joe Storch, who is associate counsel at SUNY on the system. And Joe is a rock star at in our area that we college and university attorneys work. He knows more about the mysteries of the Clery Act than anybody in the country, I think. And he's done a lot of work in the area that we're talking about, which is sexual misconduct on campus. So without further ado, we'll get started. And I will say, from my perspective, and all the bad things that happen at campus and on schools, sexual misconduct has increasingly been taking up more and more of my attention. In higher ed, our 900 schools, universities, and college members in higher ed have been consumed by student-on-student sexual assault cases since really before 2011 in the Dear Colleague letter that came out that year. And one of the things I use in 2015, last year, for the first time, and we require our members to report all sexual assault occurrences, even if they don't result in any kind of litigation or a claim. So for the first time, sexual assault occurrences last year exceeded slips and falls in reported incidents to us, which was a bit of a milestone that we didn't really want to see, but we did see. So we are doing that. In the public K-12 area where we're also active, and that's public K-12, along with school bus accidents, sexual molestation, educator sexual misconduct in the broad term, is the most serious kind of claim that we see over the 30-year period that United Educators has been in existence. And then at the 494 independent K-12 schools that are United Educator members across the country, some of our worst claims have involved this particular topic. And that this issue, for those of you in higher ed, and you know, we see a new headline every week, whether it's in higher ed or in independent schools. Independent school sexual misconduct is very hot. We're told that the Boston Globe Spotlight team is about to come out with the beginning of a major series focusing on independent and prep schools in the New England and the Northeast. So you can imagine how everyone's sort of on tenterhooks waiting for that to come down, and we're told that that may come down Sunday. So tonight, this is a huge topic. We have a little more than an hour. We can only scratch the surface on this. What we hope to do is have a fast-paced conversation among the four of us. If anybody wants to jump up and down and ask a question, I'll take it during that, but we will have some time for questions at the end. But we want to make sure we address what you're interested in. And but you come from both the higher ed and the K-12 community, as well as I know the Art Students League, which is even a little hybrid of both of those, I would say. So we're going to try to address everything. You know, my 5 cents about this is, and we'll address all of these topics tonight, but the overriding message is be prepared, because these issues are going to hit your school or campus. There's just no question that you'll have to deal with them. And you have to know your obligations. You have to have the policies and procedures in place. You have to train your staff and students. You have to respond and report appropriately. And you have to be prepared to counter negative narratives that the media will have when it comes down. And this will range from, you know, your campus media to the New York Times and the international editions of many newspapers all over the world and media reports. Al Jazeera was doing something on sexual assault not too long ago. So I'm going to start with a couple hot topics. And one of the things I want to focus on, and you do have a copy, all of you, of in your materials, of the United Educators claim study of sexual misconduct in higher education that came out last year. And one of the things we saw there that countered to the media narrative that athletes may not actually be disproportionately involved in these kind of claims, but certainly the media narrative is there. And there is a lot of talk about how do you deal with subcultures like athletes and Greeks, fraternities, and sororities. So I'm going to turn to Joe for the first question and talk about how you're dealing with athletes at SUNY, because some very interesting things are going on.
Yeah. Can everyone hear me in the back? Is this mic working? Okay. Well, first, I want to thank Rob for that much more than kind introduction, and thank everybody from Venable for inviting me. What an honor it is to be with you, to come down from tropical Albany to even more tropical New York City. It's great. We're expecting the snow to start anytime soon, so it's nice to be down here in the South. And, you know, as I think about this and I think about Rob's question, one of the foremost things I think about is a retort that I often give to my SUNY clients is I'll get a call naturally as the attorney. They'll say, we have a question about liability. And I always say, I don't want to talk about liability because, you know, liability is fact specific and I don't know what some judge is going to do and who knows what. What I want to talk about is how you're going to avoid that incident in the first place. Because as much as SUNY enjoys winning cases, we are much more happy when there's no case to bring in the first place because no incident occurred. And so that's something that we really focus on is thinking upstream, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the sort of the forward-thinking part of this. But specifically to athletes, I read Rob's report with a lot of interest because in the media there is a story about the big bad athlete. And so we looked at it, and there was not a statistically significant increase in percentage among their claims involving an athlete either as a respondent or a victim. There was a slight increase and a slight increase also for students who are members of fraternities and sororities, but some of that is reporting bias and there's a lot of other things that go on when you have a sample like that. And so we took a different approach. I went and trained the SUNY Athletic Conference, the SUNYAC. They're not quite the SEC. That none of them are going to a bowl game. This actually none of them have football to even go to a bowl game, but they're a great Division III conference, and they had a murder at Brockport and another horrific murder at Geneseo, both of which involved student-athletes. And the SUNYAC students, student-athlete leadership decided that the issue of dating violence prevention is going to be the signature issue that they work on, and so they brought me in, and I brought in somebody else, and they were surprised because I didn't spend any time yelling at them. And what they were used to is people coming in to talk about sexual assault, yelling at them about how athletes are bad, and you're trying to cover things up, and you're all really bad. And we shifted the conversation, and it got us a great response. Instead of telling them how bad we were, I said, you're just about as bad and good as everyone else. Statistically, I don't see much of a difference between you, especially as D3 athletes, and the rest of the students. What I do want to do is recruit you to be pro-social models, because when we in SUNY require training, we offer training to everybody, but we require that all our athletes complete training before they compete in intercollegiate athletics. We require that all our student club and organization leaders complete training before their club or organization can be funded. And the reason is not because we think they're more likely to be victims or more likely to be assailants. We think it's more likely that they're going to be leaders. So what I want you to do is I want you to learn about this. I want to take you to take this seriously. And I want you to model positive behavior so all those people that are looking to you are going to look to you as someone positive pro-social behavior. And the conversation just shifted. And in the Q&A, they said, we saw this old guy come in, which I love that I'm an old guy to these. We saw this old guy come in, and we thought you were here to yell at us, and that's not what, like, to them, I, like, fought in Vietnam or whatever, but I'm sort of that old. But it shifted, and the response from them has been tremendous, and the number of things that they're involved in, the number of initiatives that they're starting, the number of work that they're doing on their own without me telling them to do so is just tremendous. So think about that. That's, again, thinking about it in a different way and trying to be forward-thinking.
Thanks, Joe. Well, Karen, you've in your sphere, you've had some student-on-student issues. What do you think is the most serious issue that you're dealing with in that area right now?
Well, certainly we've had a lot of student-on-student issues, but I think that really what we're dealing with in the independent schools right now is the alumni coming back and bringing claims that they've been abused by faculty when they were students at the school. And as you referenced, there keeps being promised a big article that's going to come out from the Boston Globe that's really going to focus on our boarding school industry. But it looks like they're also picked up some of the day schools about what's really been happening in that area and where how we're going to deal with it. And Is that better? Do you hear feedback on it? Is it better if we hold it up? This is a couple things a little differently than what Joe's talking about. We do obviously want to be proactive. It's a little hard to be proactive in our industry when it's already happened some time ago. And obviously what we're doing in our independent schools is suggesting strongly that they have really good policies and procedures. So we don't see this now. We don't see it going forward. And that once they, you know, once you've been aware of this, we look now at all the policies and procedures. But what I'm finding that's most important in dealing with these alumni situations is really making sure that you're not trying to sweep it under the rug, but that you're really dealing with it proactively in the sense that you are, being courteous and respectful to the alumni that are coming forward. You don't try to undermine or belittle what they're saying, that as soon as possible, you obviously want to bring in an investigator to investigate the allegations. And treating people with respect and dignity seems to be the thing that is most important, because what we're seeing is some of the cases that have blown up and have become most sort of contentious are the ones where, you know, it's sort of denied or not respected. So we're really being careful about that. The one way we are being proactive, though, and again, it's something that I've been strongly recommending. My peer lawyers aren't always as supportive of this. is that if there's a school that hasn't had necessarily an allegation brought against them or brought up, that we send out these proactive letters. And we say, look, we don't believe that there's been any, we're not aware of any allegations that have been brought. We don't believe there's any, but we certainly want to protect our community. We have respect and we want to make sure that no one has been injured or if someone was abused that we're aware of it. And so we send out these letters saying, please make sure that you come forward. We really encourage you to come and let us know if anything happened. And there's been a number of these letters that have gone out. A lot of my clients or our clients have started sending these out. And what's interesting is...
Are you recommending that? Because I know that's a big debate within the community.
Yes, I'm very strongly recommending it. Because I think that one of the things that we're seeing is it's this. There's a common secret. So, when we do these investigations, one of the things that we're hearing, and we don't do the investigations, but when they're investigated, is everybody knew. Everybody knew. All the faculty knew. All the parents knew. And, in fact, it's, again, since it's K-12, kids know a lot of things that they assume faculty know and they assume parents know, and, in fact, they don't. So that's why it's really – I'm strongly recommending it, because one of the things that we're hearing when the abused – when the victims come forward is exactly that. Everybody knew, and not necessarily did they. So if we can encourage that to come forward, or people to come forward, we're finding that it's sort of, not that it solves the problem, but it gives some sort of solace to the people that were victims. So I'm really strongly
saying you do have to be prepared that people will come forward. Joe, I'm going to ask you, and we didn't talk about this, but do you have an anonymous reporting system where people can reveal past misconduct directed at them?
Yeah, it's campus by campus. We have anonymous reporting systems essentially at all campuses, and they're all slightly different because they're run out of the campus. There's no uniform way of doing it. And we do say on there, and this is something key to think about for anonymous reporting mechanisms, is we say on there that we are interested in hearing all reports. However, what we can do with them is based on the nature of what the report is. So if a student says, I was sexually assaulted in the residence halls in 2007, what we can do with that is, when in 2007? I was sexually assaulted in the residence halls last week. What residence hall? I mean, we have some places that have 2,000 beds, 3,000 beds. So, we say that the more information you give us, and we encourage you to come forward to an individual who can provide confidentiality or an individual who can provide privacy, which are defined terms for us. But you do want to be clear that if someone just writes, I was sexually molested at your independent school when I was a student there in the 1970s, you don't know. And by the way, we also have a very weird thing in our anonymous where there's these bots that for reasons of trying to figure out spam or whatever will fill out any online thing they could find and submit it. So we get unbelievably weird anonymous things. But because some of them are drop-downs, they'll drop it down. So it'll be like, we have a report of a sexual assault in the residence hall on the basis of disability by somebody who is out of the country, and it's just like, we look at it and it doesn't make sense. People call me up and say, should we put this in the CLEAR Act? I don't even know what's going on here. So just sort of be aware of that from the anonymous.
Yeah, so, So just in terms of our independence, our K-12, when we send out these letters, we don't do those investigations internally. And so in terms of anonymity, what I recommend and what we're generally doing is saying, look, we really encourage you to come forward. And we've hired an investigator. And obviously, I would be the one to engage the investigator so we can make sure that it's attorney-client privilege. But we've hired this investigator. Don't call us. Call the investigator so that person can conduct this investigation. And because we're really looking for an independent investigation. That's where a lot of schools have gotten into trouble, by not creating these independent situations. So in terms of anonymity, obviously, for our K-12s, we're not doing it as much internally, or we're not doing it internally. So
we'll talk about more of the investigations in a moment, but that does bring up the issue, once you learn about something, how do you treat it? And I will just relate, it is interesting sometimes what turns out. I can remember a case where someone finally reported a faculty member that was harassing her, and then as we dug into it and investigated more, we found that there had been a support group among fellow victims for over a 20-year period in this particular city. And for some reason, a lot of people knew, but it never came to the attention of the school. Once this happened, it did, and then that particular faculty member lost his job. I'm going to turn to Doreen because she does some of these faculty student investigations and ask her what's the most important thing she wants to say about that issue.
Sure. With the faculty student investigation, it's important, thank you, especially the case that I'm working on now. The school needed to hire, although they could handle it internally because they have Title IX investigators, they chose to hire an independent investigator to come in and conduct the investigation because deans and administrators of the school were being accused of sexual misconduct and race discrimination. So in that context, it was very important to hire independent investigators so that there were no issues of impartiality. We've been doing the investigation now for 6 weeks, and it is we've been learning that the students, because they are now so aware of bringing Title IX claims and how to bring a Title IX claim because they're trained on it, they are actually bringing the claims, and they're not legitimate claims. And so it's important to...
So false reports.
Not false reports, but exaggerated reports, issues that would never fall, that would never fall under Title IX, are being raised as Title IX violations, and in fact are being threatened. If you don't monetarily compensate me, we are going to report you to OCR. So the investigation that we're conducting is looking into these issues, and it's important to do a thorough investigation and keeping it very separate from the school.
Okay. Well, the other thing I wanted to talk about is that the world really did change in 2011 with the Dear Colleague letter, and virtually everybody changed the policies and procedures. Many ended student disciplinary panels. Some went to outside investigators only. Some went to a single investigator model where the investigator both recommended responsibility, non-responsibility, and a sanction. There now seems to be some reaction against some of those changes, and I wanted to talk about that. In the last couple months, there have been a number of cases where courts out there, California Court of Appeals last month, a federal judge in Boston regarding Brandeis last week, a month or so ago at George Mason, a public in Northern Virginia, a federal judge there, all questioned whether there was fairness being offered to students. And I wanted first Joe's reaction to that. He thinks they're fair all the time, but we have a slight disagreement on where this is going. But I think that's a live issue out there, that however you do this, we at United Educators always emphasize you have to be fair. If you look at the Dear Colleague letter, it talks about equal treatment. And but the problem is these are not easy cases,
yeah.
And you're always going to have at least one person unhappy at the end of an investigation, if not two. So what do you think of this fairness issue that's now percolating along?
So I have a phrase I like to use about that. In 100% of our cases, 50% of the parties are unhappy with the outcome. And in about 50% of our cases, 100% of the parties are unhappy with the outcome. And that is just the world we live in. It's never a happy time to work in student conduct. That is the world we live in. I think, and I think Rob has a different perspective, and I don't know that he's right or I'm right, or maybe we're both right, but I actually think that there's really nothing new under the sun in these cases that have come out. I read them, and every single one of them, to me, is based on a specific factual situation, but it is not, none of them are of the weight of, let's say, the Fourth Circuit opinion that came out earlier this week that said that the school district that said that a born female who identifies as a male can only use this bathroom versus that bathroom, that's just plainly violative of Title IX. That is a full change, a full shift in the way that a number of school districts, thousands and thousands of school districts would have treated the same thing. That is a fundamental constitutional, statutory, language, legislative, regulatory change. I look at all of the Title IX college level. I don't I don't read the high school ones. I my plate is full just reading the college ones. And they're always chipping away at some mistake. And to my read, 90, 95% of the time, it's not even a fundamental constitutional due process question that's being overturned. It's a, your policy said you would do X and you didn't do X. And so you violated your own policies, and that's why we're turning it around. Because if you think about constitutional due process for our students, it's really owned by the Goss versus Lopez case. And Goss versus Lopez, one sentence on it, you had a student in maybe elementary school, middle school, they thought she had some drugs, and the principal said, you have drugs, and she said, I don't have drugs, and he said, you have drugs, get out. And the Supreme Court says, well, that seems like due process to us, and which would surprise all of you who have hearing panels and investigators and all of that, but that's still the last word that the Supreme Court has given us on what constitutional due process is in the student setting. Notice and an opportunity to be heard. This is what I think? I don't think so. Good enough for us. And so we're still, the whole law is owned by that. So I've never seen a court that said fundamentally, you know what, college, you just can't kick people out for sexual assault. You just can't do it. You have to use clear and convincing, beyond a reasonable doubt, all these things. Now, I will tell you that there are a bunch of groups that write these letters, and every time one of these cases comes out, they try to weave them into a thread. There is a fundamental sea change, and we're going to go after these, and somehow, I'm not even sure how they found out about me, but I'm like enemy number one for the anti-misandry movement who like posts on my LinkedIn. If you ever looked at my LinkedIn, you'll see all these really, really crazy people posting on there, and they have web like discussion groups about how I'm going to like, what my favorite one is when the Supreme Court overturns the Violence Against Women Act and Joe Sorch is taken out in handcuffs from the SUNY building, which I don't know if I want to explain to them, like, that's not how it works, but fine. But they have this fantasy about me being let out in handcuffs, sent down to Guantanamo Bay. And I just don't see it. I just don't see that major sea change that we're seeing in other areas of the law.
Well, it's not there yet, but I mean, one thing we do agree on is if you promise someone a certain process and you don't give it to them, the judges are going to routinely find that you violated your student handbook's promises or your contractual promises. I think, though, in this constitutional due process area, it's not there yet. There's not a sea change. But all of us, how many of you remember Ed Stoner's model student code that for handling higher ed? It emphasized that this is not a criminal process, that these are disciplinary processes, that they fundamentally have an educational purpose. And therefore, all this lawyering that goes on about, you know, how complex the charging document must be, or how many times you have to give somebody an opportunity to look at something, or what kind of process you have to follow, that was the gold standard. But that's changing, and that's where I think we're getting some threats from, again, from just the perceived unfairness, because the fact is, when we take action against a respondent, and it's usually a male, but not always, in a student sexual assault disciplinary hearing, we are fundamentally changing their life. They are going to get kicked out of school far more often than not. They are going to now, more increasingly, I think in New York State, it's required to have a transcript notation that they were dismissed for sexual misconduct. And in some cases, they're going to have to register a sex offender. So I think that's part of the issue where they're saying, the courts are saying, time out. You know, it's kind of what we do every day is look at these due process fairness issues, and we're going to make sure that you educational institutions do what you promise, and we're going to make sure that there's not any lack of fundamental fairness. That's what they're talking about.
And I don't disagree with any of that. I don't see anyone making the leap to adding constitutional protections only, you know, if you look at the Safe Campus Act, which a couple of Republican legislators proposed, and it would, you know, it's
going nowhere, we all know.
It's going less than nowhere, maybe, but I mean, it would add these things, and it said, for sexual assault, you must A, B, C, D, E. We're going to make it impossible to kick someone out for sexual assault, especially if they're a member of a fraternity, because that was what it was based on, making sure we protect members of fraternities. And they made that clear. It was written by the Interfraternity Council. Fine. No problem. Everybody could be a lobbyist. Great. Fine. But if you were sexually harassed someone, none of those rules would apply. So it would be – I mean, we talked about it, and I was helping out a couple of higher education groups in thinking about it. And I said, well, here's what your response should be. That you should say, well, here's what's going to happen under the law. A student's going to come in and say, I was viciously raped. And we're going to say, well, we can't handle that. Can you just say that he called you a dirty name? Oh, okay, he called me a dirty name. Oh, okay, well, we could expel him for that, and we have different rules and all that kind of stuff. And what an insane world. But I will tell you, there was a very prominent university, very, very prominent in the south of here, that they said they were featured in a story in a music magazine a few years ago, and they said, among all the other things with that story, fine, but one of the things they said was that in their history, which goes back to Thomas Jefferson, by the way, like it's quite a bit older than me, their history, they had never expelled someone for sexual assault. And the crazy thing to me is that school has an honor code where plagiarism is an automatic dismissal instantaneously. And so we used to say when we were talking about it at SUNY, we used to say if you go to that amazing university and you're sexually assaulted, you should go to the dean of students, you should go to the Title IX coordinator, you should say, that person, what he did to me, it's unacceptable. He took my paper and he turned it in to his professor. And that's how we're going to get action on sexual assault. And that's just crazy. So I don't actually see, outside of those sort of crazy little things, I don't see that leap. But I agree with Rob entirely. Say what you mean and mean what you say in your student conduct codes to make sure that everything you do is and train your hearing officers and train your investigators and train everyone in your process, including if you have students in your process, whatever, to make sure they fully understand and you don't make minor mistakes or a series of minor mistakes. And that's really, I think, the way to best move forward.
Well, after the hockey game, we'll have a cage fight on
this. Well, can I just say one thing about this? I want to make sure that the K-12s realize independent schools, we're not covered by Title IX. So these
unless you receive federal funds.
Right, unless you receive federal funds.
And it's
right.
Worth looking to make
yes.
sure that you don't.
It's very worth looking to make sure that you don't receive federal funds. And if you do, give them. No. But again, we're not generally covered by Title IX, so these conversations in terms of your constitutional rights and various things like that don't apply to us. Having said that, I just want to follow up that the policies and procedures is where we're getting into conflict. And if you don't create really strong policies and procedures with regard to investigations of sexual harassment or sexual misconduct by student against student, then you are going to be in trouble. And if you do create these really good policies and procedures, making sure that you follow through with them, with the one thing being most important, is how will you deal with reporting to colleges and universities if there is some misconduct? Because that's where, surprisingly, we're seeing the challenges in the K-12s is there's nothing in the policy that says if you've been disciplined, we're going to report it to colleges, and I don't need to tell any colleges and universities in this room that you want to know that. And so we don't report, or we do report, and parents go apoplectic that we're going to do that. So again, in following up to yours, please make sure that you do create these policies and procedures and that you check and make sure you're taking no federal funds.
And New York has this weird wrinkle in its CPLR that you can, unlike the 49 other states, you can file an Article 78 against a private corporation for not following its own policies. That is so weird nationally, but we have it. So Cornell University and SUNY Cortland can be sued in exactly the same way, even though we have constitutional due process, and at least, or let me take a full private. Columbia University and the College of Optometry can be sued in exactly the same way, even though we're covered under full constitutional due process and they are a private organization, and your clients are totally, they're not even on the federal government's radar screen. They could be sued for not following their own policies.
The same type of law applies in California now, and the federal judge in Brandeis used Massachusetts state common law to reach the same kind of thing. So, anyway.
Just to make one point on the policies,
yeah.
It's so important that if you have a policy, it can't just be a paper policy. You have to really be able to implement that policy. If it looks good on paper, that's one thing, but from some of the investigations I've done, you look at it and you try to follow it, and it's not easy to implement. So make sure that you have a policy that you're following it and that you actually can implement it and it makes sense to the students, the faculty, and all of the employees.
And that's the worst thing you can do is create a policy, copy someone else's policy,
yeah.
And don't teach your staff about it and don't follow it. We're gonna segue now into the next question, which is conducting investigations. And investigations are a very, very broad topic too. And I'm going to start with Karen and talk about the single most important mistake that schools do when they do conduct investigations. She's going to talk about it from the independent school context, then we'll talk about it a little more from the higher ed context. Karen.
There's a couple things in terms of our independent schools and the investigations. One of them, obviously, is that you really want to create an independent investigation. So it is, nobody should be, or I don't think that anybody in-house should be doing these investigations. And again, these are with the alumni coming back. In terms of the student-on-student, again, having really strong and good policies and doing these basic investigations in-house is not unreasonable. We have, you know, many, many of these sort of challenges or claims that come up in a whole wide range of ways. So student-on-student, having good policies and then doing the investigation and making sure that your administrators who are doing them are well-trained. Doreen and I were talking about this recently where you want to make sure that your administrators understand, so when you take these notes, what exactly do you have to take? You don't want to just scribble with no dates and no, you know, person that you're speaking with, but you want to be careful about those. In terms of the alumni victims that are coming back, those should absolutely be out. The investigators that are independent investigators that have no connection to your institution in any way, that those investigators should be hired by counsel so that you have the attorney-client privilege, that you retain that attorney-client privilege. And obviously you want to make certain that there's lots of communication out to your community that says, we have this allegation, please make sure that if you have any information or any knowledge that you come back and that you call our investigator because he or she is conducting this independent investigation, giving out email addresses and telephone numbers, obviously. And one of the big challenges we've seen in the industry recently was a lawyer who was representing one of the boarding schools, and obviously they were going to conduct this investigation, and she hired to do the investigation somebody else in her firm to do the investigation, which is kind of hard to be independent that fashion, or at least the victim didn't think so. And it happened to be her husband who conducted the investigation. So as you can imagine, the victims were less than pleased, and I think in some ways created a relatively large havoc on that front. So that's what we're seeing in terms of investigations.
But so are these independent investigations, are they privileged on the attorney-client privilege, or are they going to be disclosed to somebody?
Well, it's a good question. There are attorney-client privilege in the sense that as we're investigating it, in general what we're seeing is that the investigator will share, and we do share with the board, the general framework and the general results that we're finding. Now, we're not going to go into great detail because obviously we have privilege requirements, privileges, privilege responsibilities with regard to the victims that are coming forward, but there is a disclosure of sorts to the board, and then in many cases there is a disclosure to the general community, and then what are the next steps that we're going to do if it's determined that, yes, there have been some, you know, violations or there's been abuse. There's also, again, the other piece of that, which is, what other responsibilities does the school have in terms of that? So what if did we know, did we not know, and how much of that is disclosed to the board? Because obviously we want to limit any ability to give this information to lawyers that may consider bringing lawsuits against us. But we are definitely seeing, and that's what victims and that's what communities are looking for.
In a good example, think about what Penn State did after the Sandusky allegations broke. They brought in an outside investigator, disclosed it, and that investigator took over basically the role of letting it all hang out and overcame and, in fact, criticized heavily the administration at the time. One of the things in your materials are a lot of the ethical rules and the model rules and questions like who is the client, who gets informed about this, when does the privilege expire, and those of you who are interested in ethics credit, CLE credit, should read those carefully. I want to go to Joe for a moment because virtually all of his investigations are conducted by scores of in-house investigators, all the students do. But is there any situation where you could envision going outside for an investigator? Maybe if the chancellor or a regent, him or herself, was the target?
Yeah, I guess I can't think of many cases where we've gone outside for an investigator. Yeah, I guess if the chancellor or a trustee or board of trustees, something like that, was the target, maybe. I guess hope that I never have that question. And luckily, I'm not the one who decides outside. I'm so low on the totem pole, I don't even see the part of the totem pole where they decide on outside counsel versus inside counsel. And, you know, we have 59 different campuses, plus we have 4 colleges at Cornell and 1 at Alfred University. And every single one of our campuses has a Title IX coordinator. Many of them have deputy Title IX coordinators. Others use a model where they deputize a number of people around the campus as investigators. And it's a model that works for us. A very, very high plurality of our cases are student-on-student sexual harassment, sexual assault, sexual violence, sexual and interpersonal violence. We have a smaller amount that is faculty or staff, either to other faculty or staff or to students or in some combination. We have a very, very, very small amount that's alumni. But and it's just a different the secondary education and post-secondary education, it's just a different world. And we generally handle that in-house, I don't even think they're comparable. They're just really different universes. So that's how we do it. And we spend a lot of time trying to develop efficiencies among our Title IX teams. We have a Title IX, STICSCA, a SUNY Title IX Coordinators Association. The chancellor says the name isn't so easy to pronounce, but, you know, it's hard to do anything when you have TIX in there somewhere. So you gotta find something. So we have STICSCA, and we get together our Title IX coordinators, and we do training, we do development of policies, model documents, things like that. We actually just had a conference on April 4th because it was the 50th-year anniversary of the Dear Colleague letter. So we had a conference marking
we
that.
We didn't celebrate that. I forgot.
We marked it. we acknowledged the anniversary. And so that's a way that we sort of create efficiencies, but again, just a very, very different model.
And the, one of the outcomes of that very different model is that none of your investigations, internal investigations, are privileged. In fact, you expect them to be looked at by lots of outsiders outside of a privileged context. So.
Well, so, I mean, a lot of the information is in there is protected by FERPA in general. Some aspects of an investigation will be privileged. A Title IX coordinator calling counsel and asking for advice on how to proceed here, there, or the other thing. If you look at Title IX's Dear Colleague letters and you look at the VAWA final regulations, really, together, you would say that much of the underlying information will be provided to both parties in the case of a dual party, let's say sexual and interpersonal violence.
That's what I meant, not publicly released.
Yeah, okay. So
the investigator is writing it specifically to inform opposing parties and expecting to be challenged by opposing parties.
Yeah, and one of the first things that I, you know, when I do investigator training, I mean, it takes a day and people leave miserable. It's like a whole day thing. This is just a short thing. But, you know, the first thing I say is from the beginning, from the moment the case comes in, you should be writing the final report. You should always be organizing towards the final report. And I remember I used the example when I went away to college, my mother, who was not a super email user at the time, but she said something very wise about email. She said, Joseph, don't put anything in your email that you wouldn't want your grandmother to read. My grandmother and I were very close. So I tell my clients, don't put anything into a report that you wouldn't want some federal judge one day to read. And the same things apply. You know, you want to be very careful. You want to be extremely organized, and you want to be writing the final report or writing things that will go into the final, with an eye at least to the final report from the moment that the case comes in.
Question on that, Joe. Who do your Title IX coordinators report to? And do they, as a matter of routine, seek advice from counsel's office to either review the report or to address the ultimate determinations, whether it's more likely than not that this is sexual misconduct?
Yeah, so we have a pretty decentralized system in which it's different. There is no one single rule for our 59 campuses. The modal Title IX coordinator will be in the president's office somewhere and reporting to the president or have at least a dotted line to the president. Often they're in HR. Very rarely anymore are they in athletics. Traditionally, a Title IX coordinator would be somewhere in athletics, they used to be the hockey coach, now they're the Title IX coordinator, and that's that. That's very, very rare. Sometimes they're in student affairs, or some area of student affairs, but I think the modal right now is they're in the president's office or the president's wing. They're reporting to them. And I think that most of our Title IX coordinators have a very good relationship with counsel, but I don't hear from every one of them every day, you know, and certainly we have a lot of different attorneys, but I think in general we have a pretty good relationship, and we also have a significant amount. We have a Title IX listserv. We have just a tremendous amount of advice that goes out under our attorney client umbrella with our Title IX coordinators. So, and that's just, I think, something that helps them. We do a lot of planning before as opposed to just responding to these cases.
And let me say, I mean, I think that's common, but there is a danger there, which is if the report, the investigation report is ever challenged and it comes out that the internal counsel has been advising the investigator whether there was any real merit to that or any that it made a difference, at least the optics of that can be lead to challenging the report as biased or somehow, manufactured or controlled by the institution. So you do have to be careful about that.
Optics is huge in all of this. I think that's a really good point, that sometimes what happens if you're looking at lawsuits is less the reality and more the optics. Perception is sometimes harder than reality, and so I think it's really valuable to go back when you have any of these things and think, okay, if I was an outsider, would I really feel like I was getting a fair deal? Would I really feel like it was impartial, and would I really feel like my concerns were being, looked at strategically and
And we constantly train our Title IX coordinators that they're neutrals. And so there are people who look at them and say, oh, this is just a victim advocate. We say, no, we have victim advocates. The Title IX coordinator is a neutral. They're looking to look backwards, say, redress the issue that actually happened, ameliorate the impact, and prevent its recurrence. But they're a neutral party, and you do want to make sure that they remain a neutral party, not on any one party's side, because that's a hard thing to undo.
Joe, you mentioned the final report being so important, but I also think the process is so important, because if you trust the process, if you do a thorough investigation, you talk to all of the witnesses, collect all of the documents, look at all of the emails, and you have a good process there, then you can trust the results and the findings. If the government's looking over your shoulder and looks at these reports and they don't see a good process and they don't trust that process, they're not going to trust the results. So it's kind of like building a house. You have to have a very strong foundation in order to get a strong house. And so if you have a government coming in and looking at the results of your investigation, in the report, you want to lay out every single thing, all the steps that you took, all the documents reviewed. I always put in the report, I talked to 28 witnesses. We looked at 3,516 documents. Get very specific so that when the government does look over your shoulder, you can say, but look at my process, and therefore my results are good.
Yeah, it's 100% right. We like to say, as your fourth grade math teacher would have told you, show your work.
And I would say the same thing. And for those of you who are UE members, you have access to a 15-page checklist that goes through all the work that should go into that consideration, and a model report that is, I think, very instructive. Yes.
Can the panel talk about how the privacy considerations of the victim play into how the investigation?
I'm going to turn to Joe for FERPA, but I will say that that's a very important question, because a lot of this media attention, why didn't you do anything about this? There's a general approach that gives agency to survivor victims in sexual misconduct. Obviously, children are different, and there's mandatory reporting in all 50 states. But when you're talking about a college student, an adult, we want to give them the agency to decide when and how they report, or when and how they follow through to prosecute if criminally, or go through a discipline hearing if it's internally. So the privacy issues are very, very important in that sense, is that you're trying to give people the agency that all the psychologists say are very important to recover from the trauma of a sexual assault. Now I'm going to turn to Joe, and let's talk about other privacy issues.
And I would I would echo everything Rob said. The only thing I would add is the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization, which we're only talking about the higher education sphere here, requires colleges to give students three choices: report to law enforcement, report to the campus, or report to nobody. And we take that very seriously, and we have a fairly robust, you know, model, you know, coming out of that. But we like to say that the victim drives the bus. And what we mean by that is they tell us where to start, where to stop, what direction to go. We are very keen on that. So on every one of our campuses, we offer resources that are truly confidential. These are people, aside from child abuse or future crimes, Tarasoff type stuff, these are people who will take whatever they hear with them to their grave. They are truly confidential, professional counselors mostly. At private schools, maybe you also have pastoral counselors. For us, we don't have that many pastors walking around the state university, but professional counselors, it is truly confidential. And then we have what we refer to as private resources. Private means, and it's a defined term, this means that these people are not going to splash it all over the newspaper or tell your friends or put it on Twitter, but they are going to be required to tell all of the on-campus professionals that policy requires, namely a Title IX coordinator, someone in student affairs, you know, whatever it may be. And we try to be very, very clear in plain language. The section of the Enough is Enough Law, 129B, that is called confidentiality is essentially that in plain language. Giving students information on confidentiality versus privacy, and steps that a college will analyze before deciding whether it will go forward against a student's wishes. So sometimes, a lot actually, we have students who come forward saying, I was assaulted, I was a victim of violence, I want resources, I need to change my residence hall room, I need to get out of the chemistry, I'm in a photo dark room with the assailant, I need to change that, but no, I don't want to go to local law enforcement, no, I don't want to go to the campus. And it is intentionally rare for us to overcome that request for confidentiality, small c confidentiality, by which we mean please don't go forward. We need there to be violence, use of drugs, a minor involved, and there's a few other factors that we use because the privacy, it would take nothing for a victim who is forced to go to law enforcement the way it is in Ohio or Virginia to put on Yik Yak, if you're ever sexually assaulted, don't go to the college, forget about their resources, live without them, because the first thing they're going to do is turn you into the police, and that's going to ruin your life for the following three reasons. And then it eviscerates everything we're trying to do. In the process, once a student starts the process, Rob's question, FERPA applies to everything in there. Now, it doesn't stop a student from reporting on their own experience, so we cannot. And the Family Policy Compliance Office of the Department of Education has been very clear on this, and so has OCR. We cannot prohibit a reporting individual, victim or survivor, or a respondent or accused from talking about their own experience in the student conduct process. But in general, subject to a few very, very narrow exceptions, we will not share it. Everything that happens is internal. It's not on the daily news. It's not in front of a courtroom, you know, those people who draw those beautiful ink, you know, watercolors. You know, we're not doing any of that. We will try to keep it private and handle it privately, but the respondent or the reporting individual can publicize as much as they want their own thing. The last beat I would say on that is we say, yes, you may publish it. You may talk about it. You may do whatever you want. However, you may not do so in a retaliatory way. So if a respondent is found not responsible and they write on the reporting individual's Facebook page, see, I told you you were a liar. Now you're really going to get it. Now this, that, the other thing. Well, okay, you've retaliated against someone for participating in the student conduct process, and those are separate charges. So I hope that basically answers.
And Joe and I, what we've articulated is, I think, the informed and certainly the majority view on these issues now. But he referred to statutes in both Virginia and Ohio, and Ohio is a mandatory felony sexual assault reporting law. So there was a student affairs vice president indicted for failure to report a few years back, not convicted. And then in Virginia, after all the unpleasantness at Mr. Jefferson's university, there was an attempt to create a mandatory reporting law saying, well, if the school learns about a violent rape, why don't they go to the police? Now under Virginia law, there's some certain steps that have to be gone through, but a school can do that. But it's one that's going to be subject to continuing controversy because a lot of people out there say, wait a minute, this is a criminal violation. Why not just turn it over to the police? Well, we know that we can't operate that way as colleges and universities subject to Title IX, but at least there is a debate going on.
And I'm going to show you a pretty surprising slide later as to why we don't just turn it over to the police.
And remembering the K-12, it's going to be different because we have a mandatory obligation to report whenever there's abuse. You've got to be a little bit careful because if it's student on student. The tough part with us is if we have some sense that there's an allegation filed by student against student, we want to sort of do a certain amount of investigation, and yet we have this duty to report. So it's a very delicate balance that you have to strike between reporting and doing your due diligence.
Well, we're going to switch gears a minute and start doing a little forward-looking discussion. And even on this panel, I know if you could tell us we would never have to deal with a sexual misconduct case again, we'd say hallelujah. But how do we get to that point? And, Joe, I commend to you his article in the materials in Inside Higher Education, where he talks about you might be able to get to that violence reduction inflection point. How do we do that, Joe?
So I wanted to just spend a few minutes on this because we spent so much time talking backwards about after a case has occurred, and I want you to think about thinking forward when times are calm about a case that will occur. So I hear often from politicians, members of the media, whatever, they say, does SUNY realize that 1 in 5 females and 1 in 13, 12, whatever it is, males are the victims of non-consensual sex? And we say, yes, we realize, and we'd like to talk about solutions. They say, no, we don't want to talk about solutions. Let's talk more about the problem. And we say, no, we'd like to talk about solutions. And they say, no. Let's talk more about the problem. So let's not follow the politicians. Let's talk about the solutions, because the numbers are actually, I don't think, illustrative of what's actually occurring. It's much more nuanced. So let's start with a heteronormative sample, 100 males, 100 females on our college campuses. We're told in climate surveys, and we've seen it in survey after survey after survey, I think people are really coalescing around approximately 1 in 5 females, approximately 1 in 13 males are being victimized by non-consensual sexual activity during the course of their college career. Does that mean we're talking about 20% of our male students violating the rights of 20% of our female students? It turns out that is not actually the case. If you look at a number of studies, both of college age and on college in the Navy, all around, we've looked at every single study we could find, it's about 4% of males, about 1% of females that commit upwards of 90% of all the sexual violence that occurs during this age range. Now, if I could figure out who these 5 people out of 200 were, I would just tell the admissions office and I would go back to doing intellectual property work and we'd be all fine. So some of our students are victims of these awful crimes, and many people, including a number of legislators, say, well, why don't we just go to the police? I'd recommend that you watch this video. Dr. Rebecca Campbell, Becky Campbell from Michigan State, did a national survey of police departments across the country, not having to do with New York, not having to do with colleges. And she looked at, you got a sample of, let's say, 100 women. Now, she had tens of thousands. But out of 100 women that go to local law enforcement, you go to the police, what has to happen? The police have to first take a report. They have to go and do an investigation. They have to go to the DA and get the authority to arrest. Then there has to be an indictment. The grand jury has to return a true bill. All the pretrial motions have to be upheld. You have to go to trial. There has to be a conviction in front of the jury. It has to be upheld on appeal. And then there's all the post-appeal habeas and all of that kind of stuff. Really 10 steps. How many of 100, how many don't make it past the first step? And to give you a clue, less than 1% of individuals who are accused of a sexual assault criminally will ever serve a day in prison. It's quite a bit less than 1%, but we like to say 1% to make us feel a little bit better about society. But how many don't even make it to the second step? They don't even call the district attorney. Anybody, guess it. 99%? Anyone else? It's actually 86% are closed by the police without going to the district attorney. Now, if you looked in New Orleans after Katrina, that was essentially 100%. They just sort of didn't want to deal with it. Oh, there were 7 offenders. We have 7 different people's DNAs. Oh, it's just too much to deal with. Let's close the case. And so that's why we don't just send every student to the
police, because if we started doing so, we would really be shutting down the pipeline of people who are coming forward. And ultimately, you'll see why we want people coming forward. So higher education and our friends in elementary and secondary, we've been experts for years at risk reduction. What did you all learn about sexual assault prevention growing up? Wash your drinks, pour your own drinks, walk in groups, lock your doors, carry a rape whistle, carry mace. We teach people how to avoid being victims, and we say, well, I guess we're all set, right? There won't be any rape because we've taught people how to avoid being victims. Well, it turns out almost all the sexual assault that occurs in our country and on college campuses occurs in situations where none of those things would matter. It occurs by people who know each other, who are allowed into the room, who are trusted to pour a drink because they've known each other for years. None of those things are actually helpful. It would be like preventing burglary by painting your car a different color. You know, that's interesting, but we don't have any evidence that it actually stops any burglaries. So what we've been doing in SUNY is trying to shift the conversation upstream, and we've been trying to talk to bystanders. And we were helped a lot by the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization, amending Cleary to require bystander intervention training. So we want them to recognize an impending sexual assault. This boggles my mind. A gigantic percentage of our students, male and female, primarily male, but also female, do you know where their entire corpus of knowledge of sexuality is before they get to college? Anyone want to guess?
Online.
Better. Online, but more specific.
Porn.
Their entire understanding of sexuality, because, you know, they all come to college, oh, yeah, I'm really experienced, you know, like, just like drinking, the freshmen are like, oh, I drink 18 beers every day. But they don't. They don't have any real experience. And so their experience, their knowledge of sex is from porn, where issues of consent are very different because they're actors. It's not real life. But they don't understand the difference between real life. It's just like, you know, they watch, you know, some reality show and don't understand why they're not driving a Bentley or whatever it is. And so they don't understand that, and that is a significant problem for us. We want them to feel empowered to disrupt. We want them to learn how to disrupt. And we want them to widen the in-group. I have a master's in higher education policy where I studied a lot of economics, and my favorite economist was Marcus Sen. He wrote about identity and violence. And basically what he wrote about is how the stronger your in-group, the more likely you are to commit violence against those outside of your in-group. That's why the Army runs a boot camp. That's why fraternities and sororities have pledges. You want to increase and strengthen the bond in the in-group. But the downside of that is that it makes it easier for you to be agreeable to violence against the out-group. Now, I disagree with Sen, because Sen is what they call a solitarist. He thinks we each have one identity, and it's basically race and ethnicity that he thinks. But I think we have a shifting number of identities. Of course, race, gender, religion. But what about geographic origin? What about the high school we went to, the athletic team we root for? We have this identity. And if you don't believe that we have this identity, I pulled some articles. You know, there were two cases at the Los Angeles Dodger Stadium, years apart, where a San Francisco Giants fan and a New York Mets fan were each beaten so badly that their brain was exposed. Now, what is the sin that they committed to deserve such a vicious, life-altering beating? They were wearing a shirt of a different team of nine guys who try to hit a ball with a stick and run around in a circle. And admittedly, that is probably the most important thing, and I understand why you would commit violence for that, but really, is it? Is that the most important thing for which we would commit violence, which is brutally beat somebody? My poor New York Jets, who was an 8-year-old who had the sin of wearing a Jets jersey at Cleveland Browns Stadium, like they're such amazing football, I don't know if they've ever even been to the playoffs, and the Cleveland Browns, a bunch of 30 and 40-year-olds, beat the crap out of this 8-year-old. An 8-year-old because he was rooting for the Jets, like we would ever harm anybody, like a Jets, like the Jets or any Jets fan could ever be harmful or a danger to anybody. This, of course, is the one that makes me most nervous long term. When I do this for English professors, they really, maybe this is
kind of an inside joke,
right? So when the relevant group is narrow, people are not going to act. The cruel irony of the bystander effect is that the more people that are here, the less likely it is anyone's going to go forward. That's Kitty Genovese. If Rob were to come over and start whacking me with a chair, not a single one of you would come forward to stop him. But if it was just three of us in a room, you know, Doreen would say, you know, Rob, stop hitting him with the chair, right? You know, the more people there are, the less likely anyone is going to do anything. And so a lot of these sexual assaults that are occurring on our campuses are occurring in places where there's a lot of people, at bars, at parties, at after hours. So how do we do that? What if we could widen the reference group? We're never going to widen the reference group to all of America or the world entire, but what if we can have our students, instead of thinking about all members of the hockey team, they think about all Eagles or all Great Danes or all Lakers or all whatever their sports team is, and we widen the reference group. It's an important thing to us. So here's our perpetrators. These are the people that really make me nervous. These people, represented by the sort of the greenish tan dots here, these are people who would never commit a sexual assault on their own, but they're negative bystanders. When they see their friend, who's a great guy, he's totally a great guy, he would never do anything wrong, he's like, comes from my high school, he's a great guy, when they see them committing a sexual assault, they're willing to join in. Because you might say to me, if it's just 4-1, how could we ever have multiple offenses? How could we ever have three guys from a suite sexually assaulting one woman? Statistically, it's impossible. It's because of these people. These are people who could go in either direction. They could be negative, they could join into the violence, or they could be neutral, or they could be pro-social and stop the violence. But the example I use, when I was growing up, it was de rigueur for the police to pull someone over for drunk driving, and then what did they do? They followed them home to make sure they got home safely, right? So no, the police don't do that anymore. So why? There's really only one answer, and it's six words, and you all know it. The best bystander intervention phrase ever invented. Somebody. No?
Friends don't let
friends drive drunk. Why? It wasn't police don't let friends drive drunk. It wasn't government don't let friends drive drunk. It was friends don't let friends drive drunk. And that changed it from, wow, you got home safe, you were so drunk, that's awesome, to, wow, you got home safe, you were so drunk, you are such a, this is being recorded, bad person. I can't use the phrase I would normally use. So it's about getting these people. So we want people to recognize that an incident is occurring by reducing the ambiguity of whether it's a crime or not, whether it's a violation or not. They need to learn more than what they understand from pornography that they viewed in high school. The belief that the potential victim is in their in-group, all SUNY Albany students, all CUNY students, all Brooklyn College students, whatever it is, become empowered to act where others do not. Understand that just because everyone else is standing around as a sheep doesn't mean that being a sheep is the right thing to do. Act, determine how they can intervene safely, and act. Direct intervention is, I want you to stop. Detour intervention, that's an even better one, which is you go to the president of the fraternity and you say, what's going on over there? You need to stop it. You need to stop it. My favorite is distract intervention. And it is it's the best thing that a student can do. Forget about violence. Forget about violence, forget about assault, any of that. What is the biggest crisis a student can imagine happening to them? Biggest crisis. Anyone here?
Dude, they're towing your car.
Worse. Much worse than towing your car. It's the same. It's the biggest crisis any of you could imagine. Losing your cell phone. Losing your cell phone is the biggest. Some of you are actually feeling for your cell phone right now. It's the biggest crisis. So what happens? You see your friend who's with somebody and they're pulling them away. You go up to them and say, oh, my God, where's my phone? I lost my phone. And they'll say, oh, my God, you lost your phone? Yeah, I lost my phone. Come on, we have to find my phone. And the guy or lady, whoever is trying to commit the assault, they'll be pissed that they lost that opportunity, but they say, you know, she did lose her phone. I mean, it's kind of understandable. You can do these things. We can get our students to do these things, and we can get them to feel proud of their role in preventing this. This is the model that I hope you go home thinking about. We know statistically the number of reports we get is significantly below all incidents. We're essentially 100% sure less than 20% of incidents are reported, and we're pretty darn sure that it's less than 10%. This is where we are. as you do a better job in getting the word out about how students can report, as the media picks it up, as students understand that an institution takes these issues seriously, your numbers will skyrocket. People who do research, we call a hockey stick, because it just goes right up. And when that happens, if you don't shift your work to a prevention model, to a significant prevention model, it will be high numbers as far as the eye can see. We see at some of our SUNY campuses, the numbers of reports of sexual and interpersonal violence doubling and tripling year over year, 7 to 14 to 37 to 108 to 215 at one institution, double, triple, year over year over year. If you don't move to a prevention model, your numbers will be high forever. You'll never be able to give the appropriate attention to each report that you need to do. That's why we talk about this as an inflection point. And you can't just say to whoever's doing the response, hey, also, while you're spending 80 hours a week doing response, could you also add another 60 hours a week doing prevention? This is a time that institutions need to double down, and they need to give additional resources and additional training and additional thought, maybe not additional people, but additional spreading out some of this work to go to prevention, because that's how you're going to bring your numbers of reports back down, by bringing down the number of incidents. That's what we ultimately want. SUNY is very good nationally at response. We have sworn law enforcement. We have really well-trained counselors. We have greatly trained Title IX student conduct. We have really good policies. We're really good at response. And this is where I hate to be, because what I ultimately want is for us to become really, really good at prevention. We want to continually look upstream to see how much water can we pull out of the stream before the incident occurs. Ultimately, I want nothing to do. I want no questions. That's what I ultimately want. I always say in my training, what's my favorite kind of Title IX coordinator? Anyone?
Unemployed.
I say bored, but unemployed is good too. My favorite kind of Title IX coordinator is a bored Title IX coordinator who calls me up and says, so, snowing in Albany? No, it's snowing up here in Watertown. That's what I want. I want Title IX coordinators who are playing Bejeweled or Bedazzled or whatever it is on their phone because they have nothing to do. This is how we get there. This is just dealing with tragedies that have already occurred. Ultimately, we want to prevent these tragedies.
We all want to get there, but we also are at the point where, there it is up here, where questions. We're going to talk some about social media, which complicates many of these issues. There's a lot of bystander intervention. I think some of the early evidence is very promising. There's a number of other things. One of the things I will recommend to you, and it's usable by anybody in this room, anybody in the country, United Educators has produced a video called Shine a Light. Now, it's directed at educator misconduct directed at minors, but it is a great 10-minute little introduction to sort of talk to people about the awareness of these issues, what things they should be looking about. And, someone will come up with something similar in the prevention area here. But there is a lot of work going on in this area trying to figure out what are the things. I think all of us are convinced that we have to change culture. But right now, I want you to ask any questions you have, and we'll do that. Yes?
Yeah, Robin, if you could just quickly mention how you and provide some training.
You know, I'm very
excited
about
you.
Indeed.
You could mention that?
Sure.
Well, UE, for those of you who are not UE members, is like TIACREF or the Common Fund. It was founded by education for education. It's all we do. Two missions, one to prevent bad things happening at campus and schools and do risk management and training programs. And the second, which is part of my role, is to provide an alternative liability insurance facility for colleges and universities and schools. So what we've tried to do, and particularly in recent years, we've tried to make it online and available to our members, are a whole host of training programs directed at students, directed at faculty, directed at staff, trying to, raise this culture of awareness about risk management, safety, and how you can do things for the students. I mean, that to make it safer for your students.
Yeah. Joe? And, we try to do a tremendous amount of training. We are often lucky to partner with CUNY, to partner with some private colleges. We run a webinar series. It is the Office of the Prevention of Domestic Violence, the Department of Health, SUNY, NISCASA, and NISCADIV, the Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and the Coalition Against Domestic Violence. The five of us run this webinar series. I'm lucky to coordinate it, and we bring in some national powerhouse thinkers, real and forward thinkers on all of these issues. And we put together webinars, and we put them out, and guess how much we charge to attend them? If you all speak at once, I can't hear. Nothing. We charge nothing. We don't pay our speakers. We don't pay me, obviously. I work for SUNY. I obviously don't get paid. But we don't charge anything. And if you go to tinyurl.com/SUNYWebinars, I would give you the whole URL, but it takes me 40 minutes to say it because SUNY has slashes and slashes and slashes. I think we have the link in there. You can go on to any of those, and we won't charge you a penny. And we try to do as many trainings as we can across the state, and we generally open them up to, people who are interested. And, again, we charge somewhere between, like, zero and closest. We're doing a full-day investigator training in Binghamton, and we're charging a whopping $10. Because we budgeted for all the stuff, and we forgot to budget for parking, so we have to charge $10 for parking. But still, I mean, $10 for a full day of hearing. We have a really, really bright attorney from Albany, from the University of Albany, and then there's going to be me. But most of it's going to be great, the University of Albany attorney, and we charge $10. So, you know, hopefully you can take advantage of some of the free resources and free training we offer at SUNY, and we don't want any money for it. Oh, I just think we're not. I think we're there. I mean, we did university-wide training where we brought in both Green Dot and bringing in the bystander. We do a tremendous amount of work with the One Love Foundation. A number of our campuses have MVP. We're doing a tremendous amount of training in prevention. I don't think anyone is actually good at this. I wouldn't qualify us as good at this. I think we're really good at this. I think we're probably one of the pound for pound. I think SUNY is better than. We're much better than any other system in the country, but I don't think we're good. I think we've got a lot of work to do. And unfortunately, we had John Krakauer, the author who wrote Missoula, and he came to the University of Albany, and I was honored. Two of us interviewed him, and he said, you could find it online, and he said something like, SUNY, you're obviously, you take this seriously, and everyone, really cheers you on and champions you, and that's so dismaying to me because it means that 49 other states, they're really far behind. And I don't think we're perfect. I don't think we're anywhere near perfect. I think we're moving in that direction, but we have a lot of work to do, until we get to the point where our Title IX coordinators are bored. But yeah, I mean, we're there, but we're not good enough.
Joe, maybe we can help you in the independent school world at least do some of this training before they even get there.
Oh, I would. Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. Legislators think that sex and drugs and alcohol begin the first day of college. And when we say to them, we had one meeting, a colleague and I had one meeting, this is 2 years ago, with a legislator, and we said, you should be requiring this training in high school. And she said, well, people don't have sex until the red zone, because she had heard the phrase the red zone. And we said, oh, no. I mean, we were going to say junior high school, but we said high school, and she nearly fell off the table. Heavens to Betsy, junior high school. Yeah.
Have you done climate surveys, and what has been the response in those surveys regarding the bystander intervention model or training that you're doing, and have you seen positive results?
We've done disparate climate surveys. We're in the 16-17 academic year. We're going to do a uniform climate survey of all SUNY campuses, all SUNY students. It's going to be the biggest climate survey that's ever been conducted. And I don't actually know that I'll have a good answer to your question until 2018-19. And probably not a really good answer until 2020-2021. Hopefully they haven't fired me by then. But when we do the third iteration, I think we'll finally start seeing some differences such that I can – because ultimately the reason we're doing such a big climate survey is ultimately I want to say, UAlbany, you're doing this program. It's actually working. But UB, you paid money for that program. And look, it's not really working. Let's all switch to the UAlbany program. We don't have enough. I mean, Rob said
And how you say it works, too, is I don't think my view is it's going to take a decade to to really start changing things. You think about Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which really affected a cultural change. How long did that take?
Yeah.
And still not perfect. Think about sexual harassment in the workplace, how the climate has changed from when I started in the workplace. But that takes decades, and we're far from perfect, too.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of work to do. And until you say things are starting to work, like bystander intervention or some of the other things that are out there being tried, it's going to take a few years to test those and get the evidence out there and then tweak them and continue. And in the meantime, you know, we're getting a new cohort of students every year, right?
Yeah. Our chancellor is very interested in data-driven changes, and so we're, I mean, and I agree with her. I mean, we're interested in what works, not just throwing money at a problem, which is actually why they never give me any money to throw at a problem. I just have to figure out all these things with no budget. But I think 10 years is probably right until we actually know what's beginning to, what's really, really working.
Any other questions? I guess we're standing in between you and the cocktail hour. So we'll adjourn. Thank you very much, and thanks for the panel.